And welcome to this episode of the Charity Comms podcast. If you're a return listener, it's great to have you back. If you're a new listener, I'm Robin, the events officer here at Charity Comms.
And I'm Sushi from the Digital Engagement Strategy team at Scope. For this episode, we decided to focus down on the charities achieving great things with smaller teams and smaller budgets.
Yep, as a small charity ourselves with a team of just 11, I must admit we've got a soft spot for our small charity members. First up, we geeked out with Scott Roberts from Haven House Children's Hospice, who created his own podcast, which went behind the scenes to chat to the amazing people running the hospice day to day.
We also spoke to Sarah Ruganundan and Gemma Collins-Ellis, a previous Inspiring Communicator Award winner from Bliss, the charity for babies born premature or sick. They let us pick their brains on how they put digital at the heart of their organisational strategy, with the aim of increasing their ability to reach every baby born premature. A pretty admirable aim.
Absolutely. Without further ado, here's our interview with Scott. Enjoy! Hi Scott, it's so great to have you here with us today. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Awesome.
I'm here too.
Oh yeah. And Susha's here too, which I always forget to mention that. I think it's because I assume that in everyone's heads, you're just there. You are there. The woman who needs no introduction, Sushi is in the room.
Thank you.
So, Scott, you started out in journalism and radio before moving into PR in the third sector. But how did you find that transition? What made you want to move into working for charities?
Well, it was quite a gradual transition, really, because I worked in journalism for 6 years. So I'm a qualified journalist. And I worked mostly in local and regional news in radio, but sometimes online for BBC and commercial stations across the south of England. And then I moved into the LGBT sector, specialising in LGBT journalism, which was quite interesting because it's not something I thought I would do. But I worked at an LGBT publication called Pink News.
Oh, yeah.
It's a good market leader for the sector. And I was there for about 2.5 years as editor and then political editor. And I built up a bit of knowledge about certain issues to do with equalities and sexual health for the LGBT communities, because obviously it's something that disproportionately affects those communities. And I was working quite a lot with Terence Higgins Trust in terms of they would send me some really good press releases and follow that up. And then eventually a job came up in their press office for a PR and social media lead. And that's how I kind of went into the charity sector. And I did journalism and charity work for about a year or so. And then I moved full-time into the charity sector. So it was a gradual transition.
That sounds very smooth.
So you moved to the Terence Higgins Trust. You've also worked for small charities. What would you say are the best bits about working for small charities? And what are the more challenging parts?
I think the best bit about working at a small charity is that you quickly, it is like a community, it's like a family. So small charities, where I'm at the moment, Haven House, we probably have around 80 staff. Pretty much you recognise all the faces in the organisation and you build up really nice working relations because there is a degree of familiarity, which I think is nice. One of the best things about small charities is that you can show a lot more impact direct, because you might not have a big team, though you actually have a lot of direct responsibility, and it's more noticeable. For instance, if you're not there or your colleagues aren't there, because there isn't someone to just pick up the role and it all continues. So
there's nowhere to hide.
Exactly, which sometimes is, you know, a good thing and sometimes can be challenging. But I think you can demonstrate more of a direct impact, and I think you can probably have a bit more freedom because it might just be you in a really small setup.
So moving on to the Haven House podcast, we really loved how in your talk you said that you decided to go for podcasting because you thought it'd be fun and accessible and different, and we also obviously had a lot of drive to create a podcast, so I think we were very much on the same page with that. And you obviously love podcasting, but how important do you think it is to have that passion for it before jumping into the project?
Well, if you're going to take on something to do additionally, along with all of your other responsibilities. You should do something that's fun. I mean, I wasn't going to say, right, can I do something that actually I don't really want to do in my spare time, which is actually just more work. And at any time you might be asked to do something more in your spare time which you don't really want to have to do. But if you know, there's no point doing something if you really won't find it fun and it's your own idea. So I wanted to do this naturally. And I think over the years I've learnt you might want to do something additional at work. But first of all, if it's a good idea and it's your own idea, make sure you'll enjoy doing it, because you're not going to have a good time if you do that in your spare time and it's not fun.
So you started your podcast, but was everyone on board?
Everyone was on board in terms of they knew that it was something that I wanted to do, and they knew that I could probably produce something quite decent from it. But obviously not everyone is familiar with having to do an interview, so I had to persuade a few people initially. I always ensure that a podcast, the person that's recorded, sounds the best.
Yeah.
And that's something which I think a lot of radio journalists do across the board.
Yeah.
I think it's an ethically quite a good... That's one of the reasons I love radios for journalism, because it's quite an ethically good thing to do, that if you want to... You're not changing what was said, but, for instance, you're ensuring that people sound as good as they would want to sound. It's actually... It helps with the process. And I think a lot of people, when they realise that an interview is just a conversation, because... Reservations about, for instance, doing a podcast, and the same about people that might be reluctant to ever have to do any type of media interview across the board.
Yeah.
And a podcast is probably the softest entry point to do anything that's broadcast, because you're doing it in house, and at the end of the day, it's not going to go direct onto a broadcaster platform.
For sure.
So generally, it's quite manageable. And then the other thing is that you. I think every person that I've found, even when they've said the cliche thing of, I hate the sound of my own voice, or you know, can we do that again? Whenever people have listened back to the podcast, it's always been a really lovely experience for me, because they can't actually imagine, they can't comprehend that that's them.
Yeah.
They're hearing them sound completely different for the first time. And I say to them, well, this is what you are like all the time when I speak to you. And they can't get over the fact that they sound so, you know... polished and slick, so, and lovely. They think it's someone else, and it's like, no, that's you. And it's amazing. And that's why it's really useful for any media training as well, because it's actually building confidence.
Yeah.
And I think every podcast I've done with someone, they've always felt more comfortable about doing other stuff after that. So it's actually helped with them when they're doing presentations, when they're going out to do meetings, or when they're doing media interviews as well.
Well, that's really interesting, because, we were thinking about, compared to video, do you think people are far more comfortable than with a mic, rather than being sat in front of a camera? It feels a little bit more informal, a little bit more relaxed. There's a bit less pressure on, because if you're just speaking, then you're just sort of thinking about how your voice is coming across and maybe what you're saying. But if you're in front of a camera, you're thinking about what you look like, how you're sitting, your body language. Do you feel like have you worked with video? If so, did you see a difference in terms of...
Yeah, and that is, I mean, to be honest, that is the reason why I went into radio in the first place.
Yes.
It's true, though. When I was at university, and some of us, we were all doing broadcast journalism, and some of us clearly wanted to go straight into telly.
Yeah.
I never really had much time for wanting to be a video journalist, because, first of all, logistically, it's a lot more challenging. If you're going out to report a story, for radio, you just take your recorder and maybe some headphones, and that's that. For telly, you've got to take the camera, you've got to take the tripod, you might have to take a boom, a sound protector.
Yes.
The cameraman.
Well, if you're a video journalist, you kind of have to do it all yourself.
Right,
and I'd rather
take
one of a little recorder and go in a car.
Yes.
And rather than having to spend time getting a tripod out and then, you know, working on the location in terms of what it looks like, white balance. And then editing takes so much longer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
imagine.
Because it's video, so the files are going to be humongous. Mm-hmm. So. Nothing gets wasted in radio, so It's a far more flexible platform because it's just audio, and you can do brilliant things with audio. You can manipulate it. It's theatre of the mind at the end of the day.
Okay, so how do you identify your audience and refine the scope of your podcast? So what did you aim for? Who are you trying to talk to? Did you have a plan in your head, or were you like, I'm going to test something, give it a go? What was your approach?
I think for audiences is that, I mean, the audience for the podcast is the same audience that we probably interact with for all of our PR and comms at Haven House. So you always have a sense of who they are. And I think that's also one of the benefits of working at smaller charities, that often you see your audience on a day-to-day basis. So working at a hospice, you see the families that we support day in, day out. I wasn't aiming for a particular new audience. It was simply a new way to interact with them and to show them something new, and to see if they liked it, really. So I really wanted to do podcasts, so it was an opportunity to try and just raise awareness a bit more of the services side and provide a platform for like the services teams to be able to kind of talk about their work and also give a bit of confidence for them. Because I think the average fundraiser is never going to be quite short on confidence. They have to go out and about, meet people to try and persuade them to support the charity. But it's different on the services side. You might not ever have to do any type of media work or any type of wider presentations externally. So it's important to try and encourage people to do those types of activities as well.
So when you released the first episode, was it pretty much exactly what you wanted to release? Or was it more like, we'll just release it as a minimum viable product and then we'll keep rolling with the punches and we'll see what works and what doesn't? What was that process like?
Well, the first podcast was with our director of care. And she listened to it. She liked it. And then we published it on our website. We uploaded it, and then we promoted it on our social media channels, and then we played it at our organizational learning day, so an away day. And then everyone really enjoyed it and were quite impressed, really. So from then on, it was just working with different staff and also volunteers. So I did one with one of our young volunteers who's done a lot of fundraising, and she's part of a bereaved family because she lost her sister to an inoperable brain tumour several years ago. And so for that podcast, it was interesting because we had previously done PR and marketing stuff with her over the years, and really been based on this incredible fundraising that she and her family have done. But we hadn't often gone into greater detail about how she and her family became involved in Haven House. So the podcast really explored that in a greater detail, and it was the first time I think that we had done something like that, because it's not easy to do any kind of PR and marketing around bereavement, not least with someone who's experienced bereavement at such a young age, and so I found that very powerful, and also I learned a lot from it in terms of kind of some of the wider issues in terms of what young people face through the bereavement process. And I think we wouldn't have been able to have done something like that if it had just been getting, for instance, her just to write a blog, because I think she probably would have simply focused on the fundraising, but she actually went into a bit more detail. So that was really useful for us.
No, that's really nice. I think that was something that we picked up on that was really great when you were in your talk, was just the way that you were like, it allows you to go that much deeper, and it allows you to, well, it allows the person you're speaking to roam into how they felt about something, rather than here's what I did and here's what happened afterwards. And that kind of human aspect of it is so important when you're doing a podcast for a charity.
I think the thing is that I like podcasting is because it kind of, I think sometimes in PR and comms we can all start getting on that treadmill of, you know, we've done this type of release before, we've done that before, and you slightly lose touch with some of the more human aspects of what you do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a podcast provides that space where you can reconnect a bit more with what the charity's about, because and I think that being able to do that or have those connections, it doesn't have to be with a podcast, but just being able to meet service users regularly and just and being able to share their stories is important, because it overall will make your PR and your comms a bit more authentic.
Yes.
So yeah, podcast is so important for that, I feel.
So I thought we'd talk a bit about tech.
Okay. I'll go very quiet. I'm not a tech person at all.
Well, during the conference, you spoke about your very lightweight kit, which obviously is useful for, I guess, taking around the place.
Yeah.
And that's great. I found the opposite. I have so much stuff. It's ridiculous. And I feel like I'm just buying more and more stuff. How are you? Do you feel like you've got a lightweight kit, you're very happy with it, and that's good for you? Or are you building on it? What do you feel about your kit?
So with podcasting, I never had to buy anything additional which I didn't already have.
Wow.
So I've had a audio recorder for many years, because obviously I used to be a radio journalist.
And what's it called?
It's a Zoom H2. So I think it costs around new £150, but you can get them secondhand on Amazon for probably £100 or maybe less. These days, I mean, you don't have to spend that much money on an audio recorder. This was probably about 8 years ago.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, if you take good care of it, it'll last. So it records in WAV, but I think we broadcast most of our podcasts in MP3, just because it's smaller for people to download in terms of file size. And I've got Audacity, which is a free editing software. It's very basic and it's quite simple to use. I don't feel that I've needed anything additional in terms of kit.
Well, also we're interested in editing. I know each episode is down to 5 minutes, but as you were saying, you record a load more and then you trim it down to that amount. So do you do the editing yourself, or is someone else on your team that does it?
I don't think we would be doing podcasts if I got someone else to do it. it's something that I've like, right,
you basically do the entire thing. Yeah. Right,
I mean, I had it's all the very equipment impressive. I knew how to do it, I knew when I could do it.
Yeah,
editing is the bit that I think is if you know what you want to include, that generally is quite, it doesn't take that long to do it.
Yeah, because I feel like something that me and Sue did, which obviously you must have done because you were in radio yourself, and I imagine you do enjoy it, so you listen to a lot of it, is that we listened to, we still do, we love podcasts, we listen to a lot of it. I think part of what we found helped a lot in the process of creating a podcast was just listening to loads of them and just like maybe picking up on things things that maybe helped shape the narrative or were compelling. And just paying attention to how they round it off, how they start it, what going into it, what sounds natural, and what transitioning out of it sounds natural, and all those little bits. There's so much out there already. You could just use those techniques. And I imagine you already had them to hand because you've done so much work on it already.
Well, I feel that listening to Radio 4 is a good start in point as well. Because the thing is with Radio 4 is they really like spacing.
Yeah.
When you have a bit of silence or a pause, that can be so powerful. And so, yeah, I think that if you listen to radio in general and, you know, podcasts across the board, I think that's a good starting point, really.
Just picking out what makes you enjoy something, like what storytelling parts you really gel with. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so you also mentioned some of the ways that podcasting has helped some of the people that you work with. So they feel more confident doing media, the presentations, they're more confident in meetings. But you also mentioned in your talk that it was good for internal comms. So I was wondering if you could talk to us about how it's helped potentially break down some silos.
I think that Haven House is a small charity. So internal comms is something where small charities, they should be better at doing it. And I think we are, because we're on a very small site and you can physically see a lot of your colleagues. So we're not on different sites across a large region. It's very simple to kind of ensure that our internal comms are quite agile and impactful. I feel it's helped with internal comms for podcasting because people are hearing their colleagues and different teams talk about areas of their work which they might not have had the opportunity to. And also, our internal comms are really simple. We have, we might have an all-staff email and we don't send that many out. And we've got something called a team brief, which is like a retrospective every other month kind of report of what everyone else has been up to and sharing their news. And that's it. And we try, as with all of our comms, to point everything onto our external channels, because actually if there is news, if we're doing something or we've got a nice story or we've got, you know, something that's, you know, we want to shout about, we really want it for you to listen to it or hear it or read it or watch it on our website or on our social media channels. It's just nice for other teams to hear their colleagues talk about their areas of their work. And it might be the first time you've heard someone from a different team speak.
No, that's really cool. I suppose that must be true of like any size charity then as well, which is very cool. Because I imagine if you are the larger charity you're in, the more likely it is that there's a load of people that you've never spoken to. But because you're in the third sector, a lot of the time you're in an organisation because you are passionate about the cause and you're passionate about the work that you're doing. So it's even more likely that you'll want to hear about the realities of their day and their work. And especially when it's people like people working at night shift or nurse teams or something like that, because it's just so inspirational listening to
stuff
that they do anyway.
Because I think, as I was saying earlier, it's really easy sometimes to get a bit siloed and to maybe produce PR and comms for the people that ask for it direct. And so podcasts can help balance that across the board and to allow people that sometimes don't get the opportunity or don't sometimes feel that they what they're doing is kind of, you know, you always hear people say, oh, no one will be interested in that, or I just do this. And then you put it together in a podcast and people are like, oh, I had no idea XYZ was doing that, or wow, that's amazing. So I feel, it helps with internal comms across the board, really.
I think that's what's really inspiring about it as well, because within the organisation or outside of the organisation, it gives you the opportunity and the space to platform voices that might not otherwise be heard. And I think that's true of what we hope to do with the podcast. I think that's true of what a lot of people are doing with podcasts. It just creates an extra space, essentially, in a place where PR comms, like, it might feel quite crowded because you've got the website and you've got Twitter and you've got Facebook and you've got videos that you're putting out. And it can feel like a little bit, oh, you've got blogs, you've got loads going on. But then because of what lends itself to what kind of platform, sometimes creating this extra format, podcasting, can create extra space for a story that might not otherwise be told, but it's really inspiring to hear. So do you have any advice for charities who might be considering trying out a podcast but are a bit nervous or apprehensive to take the first step?
Yes, so I would, first of all, you want to keep your podcast quite short to begin with, and then if you want to lengthen them, you'll probably be in a better position to do so, because with a shorter podcast, first of all, it doesn't seem so daunting. And also, your audience might feel easier to listen to something short to begin with and then to listen to longer things once they've built up a bit of rapport with the platform. So I would say, to begin with, keep a podcast to 5 minutes and go for a interview one-on-one format. So don't try and interview more than one person to begin with. Concentrate on what they're saying and edit it so that it's really a conversation around them and you, and to keep it simple as well. So whenever you listen to Radio 4, it's quite simplistic in terms of the production. It sometimes you might listen to a program where there's no sound effects or music, it's simply a narration and the interviewee. So go for that to begin with, and then you can see about incorporating music or other aspects, because it just means it'll be simpler for you to do. And then finally, just always bearing in mind that it's not a live thing, so you can go back to it. If your interviewee wants to start again, that's fine. And you can record your intros and outros separately, and just have fun with it.
Yeah, that's great. I completely agree as well, because I think the keeping it short thing, one of the things we've always really loved about podcasts is that it's so flexible. You don't have to have like a half an hour long program, you know? You can have a 5 minute one, or you can do an hour long one. Ours tend to come to an hour-ish. And I've always fretted about whether it's too long or whether it's too short, and Sue's always like, doesn't matter. Someone wants to listen, they'll listen.
The length of podcasts can change quite substantially sometimes, because I've seen podcasts when normally they're around 30 minutes and then sometimes they're 40 minutes and then sometimes they're 20 minutes. It all depends at the end of the day if you've got the content. So if you've got a really great guest, you go on a bit longer and a bit longer, and even radio does that, right? You know, TV is timed to the second, radio is timed to how long, you know, you've got in an hour. So you can think, okay, all right, we'll go a bit longer with this interview with me, and we'll drop the travel for this hour. People do that all the time.
I mean,
when I used to work as a newsreader, people would always, sometimes on certain programs, they would come to the news about 3 to 4 minutes late because, we had so and so on and we just had to go on a bit longer, you know. I was like, people want to hear what the news is. So, don't get too worried about how long you do something for. Just if it sounds good and it's going well, you can lengthen it. But don't feel that you need to go to any particular amount of time to begin with.
Agreed. That's why I think it's such a good tip. Cool. Was there anything else you wanted to touch on? Was there anything else you wanted to chat about podcast-wise? Anything you think we missed that you were like, this is a useful thing to talk about?
No, I feel that it's very comprehensive.
I know.
I'm just delighted that you had me at your conference, because it was really, lovely to hear so many other people talking about the different innovative work they're doing, but also people saying, oh, I'm really encouraged to go into doing podcasts now.
Yeah.
I think that's clearly a good sign that podcasts are on the up for charities, which you obviously know already. And I think it's great that, you know, more and more charities are trying them out in podcasting.
Definitely. Yeah. You're going to be one of the founding fathers of the podcast movement in the charity sector.
I wouldn't go that far.
I think
other people were doing it before me.
Not that well, though.
Other charities have been doing it.
Well, thanks so much for coming in and chatting to us. It's been really interesting.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I think it's clear that we had a love of podcasting in common with Scott. It was really, really interesting to hear another person who's sort of a veteran of podcasting rather than podcasting within his own charity. And he just made such a compelling podcast on a real shoestring.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, obviously, we love podcasts. We have created one. And we share his love of them. We know that it doesn't take all the tech in the world and all the resources in the world. And, you know, really, you just kind of, you can work it out as you go along.
Definitely. And I think that it's so inspiring to hear someone just be like, there are such great stories here. Let's find a way to share that with people, and in a way that really feeds our service users and people who would be looking for this information. And I think that he really nailed getting that concept down.
Yeah, definitely. Also innovating with the fact that you might have low budgets, and kind of clearly letting his passion drive his ambition to create it.
Absolutely. Well, yeah. He did a really impressive job innovating on a small budget, and our next guests are a great example of this too. How do you go about an organisational strategy overhaul to put digital at the heart of everything you do? Bliss recently underwent this process, and Gemma and Sarah from the charity gave us the lowdown. Here it is. Sarah and Gemma, it's so lovely to have you in today. Thanks for coming to chat to us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
We've got Sush in the room as well.
Hello. I'd just like to say I'm very sick.
Yeah.
So I want to apologise for all the sick sounds that you're going to hear, the rustling of the tissues. We're also in quite a noisy office today, so you will hear some background noise, but Robin's going to do her best to take it out.
I will try my very best. I apologise in advance. We thought we would kick off the interview with just a couple of questions about just your intro into the third sector, stuff like that. So how long have you both been in the sector? Did you come in from a different profession? Did you come from a corporate sector? How did that happen for
you worked there?
So I have always worked in the third sector, so I've never been outside the world of third sector. I started off in a charity, National Literacy Trust, and then worked for the Met Police and started doing a lot more digital work with them. So that was a really interesting place to be, huge organisation, very pressured environment, really interesting place to go to work. And then I worked at the National Housing Federation. I became digital manager there. And then I ended up at Bliss as a digital lead. So, yeah, that's my working life.
Yeah, I've been at Bliss 4 years. Absolutely love it. But before that, I was also in a small charity called the Lullaby Trust. Yeah. So a similar sector. I'd heard of Bliss before, and so it was kind of a natural next step. But before then, I worked in regional newspapers, so I cut my teeth in journalism. And I did that for a few years. So bit of a mix, but all you know, comm stuff.
Yeah, a lot of the people we have on come from journalism. Yeah. So I think that journalists are probably in the third sector.
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah.
How did you find that change from journalism into the third sector?
It was quite a big change. I think the pacing is very different. Journalism is fast-paced, even when you're in, you know, local and regional news. Things happen quickly and you're working to a deadline. And so it was quite an adjustment to plan things over several months and really have time to kind of get into the detail of a project. And that was really nice. I liked that. And being able to be much more creative and to write differently and to write for different audiences instead of sort of the same audience and in the same style was really nice. So I found I had a lot of transferable skills, but I just really loved being in the third sector and enjoyed going to work every day. So I can't imagine leaving now.
Yeah, like a lot of small charities, as we hear more and more, Bliss has been on a journey to embrace digital, and it's sort of really transformed how you work. So how does the organisation look today compared to what it used to on the other side of that transformation?
Yeah, so 4 years ago when I first started at Bliss, like a lot of charities, there was a lot of print. So we provide a lot of information for families and everything was print first. So we'd always be making a booklet or a leaflet and we'd be printing loads of stuff out in the office. And that was just the way that we communicated to parents on the neonatal unit. And to a certain extent, that's still we still retain some of that because our supporters are physically in one place. They're in a neonatal unit for a couple of days or a few months. So they do still need some of that physical support. But just the way that they interact with us is completely different. They've also, you know, demanding content in different formats, which is right, and we should adapt to that. So today we do that. We create podcasts, and we, you know, our social channels have grown enormously, and our website so much more accessible and usable for them. So instead of thinking what leaflet do we need for them, we're thinking actually what do they need first, and then what format do they need it in, and what are the limits to that, and how can we be creative and create something in digital first if possible, but also, you know, multi-channel where they need it. So we're really thinking much more about what they actually need instead of thinking that in that kind of old kind of print way.
Yeah, just centering your audience in all those decisions.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Yeah, for me as well, because I came in when Bliss was already very much at the beginning and almost sort of partway into the digital journey. So coming in as digital lead, it was like gold. It was like coming in, I was like, oh my goodness, this is incredible.
A digital person.
Yeah, and everyone was coming up to me when I started, and they were like, oh, we want to do this, we want to do this. And I'm like, whoa, there's only one of me. Hold up. But it was the most wonderful place to be, and SMT were really on board and everything.
Well, you started to touch on the success you've had with your digital strategy. And we all know it's been very successful. And I'd like you to show off now and tell us about some of those successes.
Yeah.
Shall I go?
Go first, yeah.
So one of the big things when I came in is that the website that we used to have was just absolutely not working for us, and we needed to move on to a new platform. And the speed at which we managed to do that and the smoothness of that project as well, for me, was one of a real sign of the success of the digital culture, because people were so on board and so up for getting involved and supporting it. We had like the entire organisation making that project happen and making it their priority as well. So whereas in previous, you know, lives I've had, you know, where you go and ask someone to you know, help you with some web copy, you need them to write or edit some pages, and they, like, for them it was very much low down the list. For everyone on this project, they would do it, and so everyone did the content migration. Everyone learnt the new CMS, and it was a really fast working, fast paced project, and as I say, really smooth. So That's literally just a few. I mean, there's so many more.
We have the social going. Media strategy as well. We kind of evaluated all the content that we'd, you know, put out on social, and then created some kind of strategy statements that helped us develop new content and think about what people actually come to those platforms for, and really focus more on the community aspect than kind of it being a, you know, a promoting platform. So that was really successful. We put a lot of investment this year into paid social media as well, which is yielding results, which is brilliant. But understanding again, like who we're targeting, and trying to like really drill down to that and make that more effective. So that's been great.
Facebook chatbot.
We're the first charity in the UK to have a Facebook chatbot. So when you set up your Facebook donate page, it takes you, it's just a bot that takes you on a journey and hopefully encourages you to sign up to our mailing list, as well as like giving you tips on kind of how to fundraise and raise more money from your audiences. Like, it gives them impact statements and graphics that they can use and share on social. So that's really effective. That's the donations that are coming in from that continue to increase, and we've had, I can't remember the number, but quite a lot of sign-ups through that as well to the mailing list, which means obviously converting those hopefully into more regular supporters, or at least people that we communicate with on a regular basis.
I think one of the other things that's been really important actually and real site success is that we focused on internal ways of working digitally as well. So this isn't about digital tools that can help us reach our external audiences, but how can we work, use digital to be more effective internally? And that for me is one of the key successes that's made a difference, because it's made staff realise that digital just impacts everything that you can do, and it can make certain things work so much better. And then from things just as simple as, like, as Gemma mentioned earlier, like not reducing our printing and actually thinking how can, you know, taking laptops around and just being more effective, as well as looking at much more bigger projects around introducing APIs for our data and getting data into our database and things like that, which, you know, is something we're working on for a long-term project. But the focus is there and the understanding is very much there, and the drive. So all these things are happening. As well as we had managers focusing on driving that internal ways of working as well, digitally. It was manager led. That was so important as well, because it made staff realize, oh, this is important. You know, this is a real focus.
Well, there's a lot to unpack there. Yeah. So I might just rewind to the very beginning. And this is something you also mentioned in your talk at the conference, which was that the digital first strategy was born out of your new organisational strategy. Mm. And as an organisation, you decided to just put digital at the heart of it. Can you tell us a bit more about, I know that, so you came on board, was it partway through that process?
So it had always been
So obviously you do quite a lot of research when you embark on a new organisational strategy. Mm. And you know, part of that was speaking to our supporters and parents. And so we did a massive piece of work on that and had thousands of parents respond to us. And there was a few things that kind of told us we needed to focus on digital. One of those was like our digital audience is growing, and people saying that they wanted to interact with us and engage with us in that way. But we did have to ask ourselves, you know, quite hard questions about what we can afford to do. And so that was part of that conversation as well. And so these things all came together, and we decided that we're going to put digital at the heart of the strategy and say that we want to become a digital first organisation. Even though at that time we hadn't really planned out exactly what that meant or how we would do it, we just said that this was our ambition. And so, the SMT and board led that. They decided that's the way that we're going to go. And then they left it to the comms team to decide that how that would be done. And that's kind of when we brought Sarah in, and how we did that.
Yeah, and coming into that as well, what was very obvious as soon as I started was, one was that we were really trusted to get on with it, so there wasn't any kind of need to constantly update or include senior managers and colleagues in terms of decision making and things like that. And it's so necessary when you want to move at a faster pace that you can just make those decisions and know that, you know, you're going to have support. I think the other thing about the culture at BIS, which has made such a difference, is that there's very much a can-do attitude and just get on and try things. And it doesn't feel ever like, if we make mistakes, it feels like that's a good thing because we learn from them. So there isn't that kind of fear that sometimes happens and can really hamper people progressing in digital because of worrying if something might go wrong. It's more like, oh, if something goes wrong, well, how can we learn from it and what can we take from it? And things do go wrong, you know, or things aren't perfect. And certainly in terms of allowing the organisation to take on digital projects, of course there are bits of it where I'm looking at it going, oh, that is not how I would do it, and all that sort of thing. But you have to embrace that. It's the same as when social media first came in and people started using it and they tried to control it too much and they couldn't actually make the most of it. It's exactly the same approach. You know, we've just got to let those mistakes happen and let people learn, and then they build their own digital skills as a result because they're doing it. It's the best way.
And I think them seeing those benefits as well is one of the key ways that you can get buy-in. So yeah, as soon as we started to prioritize digital, and you know, for example, doing some of our digital marketing, people say, oh my god, yeah, that's actually really getting results. I want some of that kind of thing for my projects and my teams. And we had this really old outdated website which really worked in our favor as a comms team because people hated it, so they were just dying for something new, and so that was exactly so they were really on board with that. And you know, because it was led by SMT and managers, and we did ask ourselves some questions at the beginning of the planning process, which I can't remember the exact wording, but they were around how we use kind of digital tools and technologies to be more efficient, and how we do the same to meet users' needs. And so those asking ourselves those three questions, but I can't remember the third one, at the beginning of the planning cycle, and having that in the templates and in the planning meant that every team was asking themselves those questions just as part of their process. And so that really helped to get buy-in as well, because they'd already started to think about it. So
yeah. I'm just really fascinated by this culture thing. It's come up a couple of times.
Yeah, so am I.
because you know, that thing cuts across all sides of charities. That you can't have good digital culture without good digital culture. It's not going to work. You know, if you don't have those things you've talked about, being trusted, that can-do attitude, where does that come from? Does that something that, you know, the organisation, because it's decided they're going to go for digital first, they've gone, right, we need to be more open, we need to embrace people, we need to get on board, we need to move faster? Or was that already Bliss's culture?
Well, I don't know if that was already Bliss's culture. It's what I came into, so it was already there when I came in. I don't know if that had been there for years before. But I think a lot of it does come from SMT, and it comes from SMT letting go, but prioritising. So they, you know, there's a very loud message about how we're going to do things, and it is through digital, but it's letting staff just get on and do it. You know, what's made the difference? Because I've worked in places where, you know, we've been trying really hard to achieve that sort of culture and doing all the right things you think and just not quite getting there. So I equally am fascinated as to why, what is it about Bliss that is working so well? I think some of it is size. So the fact that, again, you know, we've mentioned it before, but when I work on projects, or for instance, the website project, which we did when we relaunched it, huge parts of my time were invested in going and having conversations with people around it and about it, and keeping everyone up to speed. And still, that for me, that individual relationships is one of the most important things about building digital culture. Because if people feel involved and empowered, and they feel that if they are getting stuck on something, they can come and access a bit more, you know, support. That's been definitely part of it.
Sounds like, yeah, there's this sort of two elements to it, which is creating and cultivating that culture in the first place, and then realizing the value of it and maintaining it so that it's not taken for granted. Because I think when you've got a team that really is giving their all into something and know and seeing the value in what they're doing, I think that can easily slip into taking that for granted, especially obviously with the senior leadership team.
Or sometimes you can get a lot of excitement generated around digital. You can start things off and then people lose momentum and then lose interest. And I think some of that stems back to that fact that it's rooted in our strategy, because people, when they were doing their planning from that strategy and they were asking those three questions, it made it really focused and it kept the momentum going.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And it kind of leads on to the idea that you don't have a digital strategy, you've got an organisational strategy that's digital first. Why?
I mean, for me, that is absolutely crucial if you're going to be successful with digital, because digital is just a tool that you can use to help you achieve what you need to achieve. It's just one of the tools. So it shouldn't be seen as a separate strategy. That's when it becomes something that's owned by the digital team, I think, too much, rather than owned by the entire organisation. Mm. So, yeah, it's just been absolutely fundamental building block for Bliss's success, I think, and making sure that we keep focused on it as a means to an end rather than as this kind of... I think it makes it more mystical almost when you start talking about digital strategy. It makes it less... I think for anyone who doesn't have digital in their job title or doesn't have that as their kind of core expertise, they then immediately go, oh, that's not for me, that's for the digital team's expertise. So you yeah. strip that away and it all of a sudden becomes something very different that everyone needs to get involved in. And for me, that, you know, we've talked a lot about culture, and for me, getting that culture is more important than getting the skill set. Because once you've got that culture, you can build the skills.
Well, I think that also leads neatly on to something else I was going to ask you about, which was touched on briefly earlier, which is those questions that you came up with, which are sort of at the heart of the decisions that each team will make. And I do have them written down, so I'll just run through them, which are: how can better digital working help improve the support you offer? How can improved digital comms help you extend your reach? And how can digital techniques and tools help to save money and improve efficiency? I was just curious to know how you came up with the questions. Was it the comms team sort of created those and then just handed them to the teams and were like, ask yourself these before, well, whilst you have them in mind, whilst making any decisions you have on operational plans you've got
going. That again came from SMT, and I believe they worked with the comms team, but this is like 2015,
yeah.
So it's quite hard to remember. So, but yeah, again, from senior management, and then we have obviously templates, you know, that we complete at the start of the year as part of our planning, so it's just in that.
And so
everyone kind of approached it in their own ways, and then we share those plans and work together. So we are about to launch a new strategy in January, and we probably would do that differently. We're in a different place now, we're more advanced, so what that'll look like going forward, I don't know, but at the time that was a useful tool to get people starting to think about how it affected their area of work and how it was relevant to them.
Yeah, I felt like they really summed up a lot of really key cornerstones of how to create a digital first environment.
Great.
The other way you create a digital first environment as well is have tools that block you so much that everyone's so frustrated, driven so much by it, that the idea of anything that works is like gold, and they're like, let's do it. I'm not even joking when that's part of what I came into, and they were like, make this work. So yeah, build up people's frustrations.
Yeah.
And then provide a solution.
Feels a bit like Brexit. Well, that sort of goes onto your website a little bit. You said it, not me. So your website, you said, was a great example of, is a great example of the success of the strategy, really, and the kind of revamping of it. But could you tell us a little bit about the process of doing that?
Yeah, so, I started and it was, immediately obvious the platform we were on just wasn't providing what it needed, so... it was immediate that we just need to move on to a new CMS. But one of the things we did to start with is we didn't just launch into, right, let's go out and find a new provider. We did a ton of research first, and we took our time to work out what we needed sort of functionally from a new CMS. We took a ton of time to understand our users and their requirements. And we did a lot of internal work as well, so working with staff to understand their frustrations with it and their needs and how they, you know, what the biggest barriers were for them.
And you did this before you went to an agency?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And okay. I really spent a lot of time on this because for me, I've had a lot of experience of working with agencies, and one of the worst things you can do is go to an agency with a vague idea. Mm-hmm. Because you will get vague ideas back and you'll get vague budgets.
Yeah.
And you'll just end up being so frustrated, and then you might embark on something and nobody really knows where it's going, and then the budget, you know, everything just goes wrong very quickly.
Yeah.
So for me, being really crystal clear and writing a really, really clear brief that then we went out with that had a lot of information and understanding. And also what was really good is internally, I think actually one thing we haven't mentioned yet is internally, what we also have is very realistic expectations. So digital can be something that people think, oh, you can deliver something really quickly and you can deliver all these things like, you know, in no time at all. And it's not the case, you need to focus still. So for website launch, we very much phased it. We knew that we could get it onto a new site, and we would prioritise a couple of areas, and then we'd look at making some more bigger improvements further down the line. So we weren't going to, you know, that minimal viable product attitude was very much at the core of it. So we focused on, from our research, we knew the two biggest issues on our website. One was the donate process, because it was hideous on the old site. People had to actually kind of log in to make a donation, which is just crazy. The structure on the old site was just terrible. And as a charity that provides information, obviously that was a really big, and that had come through from the strategy research, you know, about how important that information is for parents when they're first in that situation. When they have babies premature or sick. So those were the two key areas which we focused on for launch. And we said everything else, which there are so many other things that we wanted to achieve with the website, has to wait. And so that was really helpful. And then because we did, you know, once we went out to brief and we knew we had such clear ideas of what we needed to achieve from this, it just made it so much more effective in choosing an agency to work with. They need to totally get you, and they need to be providing the ongoing support that you know that will work, and at a cost that you know will work for the organisation.
You sort of mentioned how when you first transitioned from the old website to the new website, that you had to kind of just grit your teeth and just bear the fact that some of the less tidy, less polished stuff was going up out there.
So, yeah.
And then since then, has it sort of been a really iterative process? You have sort of been putting things out, and then as you've gone along, have you been retesting things down the line? Has that continued in that strain?
Yes.
Yeah, very much so. So in terms of the content, like when we migrated it all across, we said, okay, we have to just migrate as is, because we've got this brilliant new structure now, so people can find it, which is great. That's always good, yeah. Maybe when they find it, it won't be as we wanted it, but we are just taking it step by step and going through the content to improve it as we can, that's realistic within the resources. And actually, you know what? When we did migrate that content, and we said, oh, we'd really like to rewrite a lot of this and make it so much better, just putting it on the new platform made it so much better. Mm-hmm. I'm so glad we did that and didn't hold ourselves back by trying to get it all perfect first, because as soon as it was in the new platform and we had much better ability to make those pages just the design and the look and feel and what we can include and how we can cross-link and everything like that was so much better, that page already was just drastically improved. So it is a step-by-step process, and our information support team, you know, they have different areas which they're looking to develop. And, they, you know, as Gemma mentioned, we've launched mental health information. So, you know, bit by bit, all of that content is improving, and we know it's going to keep on doing so.
So we've talked about the idea that Bliss's size is its strength. Mm. So what do you think are the biggest advantages for working in the smaller organisation?
There are so many.
That is the right answer.
Okay. There really are, though. I mean, okay, so one of the biggest advantages is that you can pretty much go to everybody and have a conversation individually and support them on a very individual, tailor basis. Mm. And that makes them, you know, I guess it works on a number of levels. One, it feels like they're getting digital support. And two, it feels like they've been listened to, so you're taking what they need into account. So a lot of it is about internal comms, like I mentioned before, in a small charity, and you can just do that in such a personable level. I guess another is that one of the things we're focusing on a lot, as Gemma just mentioned around, is the training. So upskilling, once you've got that culture, then you can focus on the skills. Mm-hmm. And so that's what where we're at now. And we've got an ongoing training program. And again, because you're small, you can go and train every single team quite realistically. Again, give yourself realistic amounts of time to do it. It still takes time and effort and energy. Mm-hmm. But you can do that, and you can do it for each team on a really tailored basis, and invest it, because it's so worth it in the long while, because once you've got them up to speed, or even if you've got one or two team members in that team, if they get really good, then they become the experts in the team, and then all of a sudden their team members are going to them instead of coming to you, which is amazing. It's fantastic. Yeah. And you have that extra support. And I think being small as well is that the decision making. So if you're small and you're constantly having to go up and, you know, get loads of decisions made by other people, then, you know, I'd say you've really got to question how you're organising your organisation. That's just so stifling. Yeah. And just being able to make decisions quickly. But it only works if you communicate properly with people, because you could still do decision making in complete silos. So just, you know, you can do that on a small level.
I think that being a small charity and digital fit perfectly together, because in as a small organisation you have limited resources, not only in people but obviously with money, and digital can provide solutions to those some of those problems. So if you are thinking in that way, you can probably find a free tool, you can probably find like a Canva or a Trello, or you can probably find something that makes video online, or you know, not just in terms of creative, but there's process digital processes you can put in place that make things more efficient internally. So I actually think that as a small charity, digital has so many opportunities for you, and so to embrace that fully means that you could be, you can do more with what you have. Well, I mean, I love being small. I think that the culture at Bliss is a really good example of how these things can work together. So yeah, that is I think the crux of it, but also the communication, like you said, you know, being able to have the comms oversight but devolve as much as possible and all feel like this, you really have ownership of things, and communications can just communicate a decision or a way of working, or and everybody knows and is on board with that.
For me at Bliss as well, the biggest thing is not budget. You know, when you work at a small organisation, the challenge often is you have smaller budgets to work with, but that isn't the challenge for us now, it's time. Because as Gemma said, there are so many free tools out there. We have the can do, just do it attitude where we'll try things. And so you can find a lot of ways of making digital tools work for you, but it, you know, then it becomes just a time investment, which then gets diluted if you upskill your entire organisation, because then you have the time of 50 people instead of sort of 3 people in a digital team, and you know, that is hugely different. So,
God, I could write a book on all of that. So thorough, it's brilliant.
That's why you should come and work with us.
It's an advert for Bliss. I think
there is I think I've said about the idea that digital matches so well with small charities. I've always believed that, because at Charity Comms is a young organisation. It's only 10 years old, and you know, we've never had to say we need to do a digital transformation project, because there's no reason to do that, because it's so young, it's born in digital, and it understands digital, it totally embraces it. You know, everyone is an editor at Charity Comms because that's the way you work. You recruit people through the website. And I think that, for me, has always been so critically important, and it's exciting. It's just exciting. And as you say, all those tools out there, there are so many developers creating fantastic tools. Let's get on board with them. Exactly that, the culture that brings people together to say, let's try a thing, let's do a thing, let's give it a go. That is all that stuff, the magic of small charities.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the last thing we wanted to ask was just if a small charity wanted to start on the road to creating their own digital first strategy and really weaving it into the organisational strategy the way that you guys have managed to, what would your advice be to them?
Start with what your users need. So get that research.
Yes.
Go out and ask those people and find out what they need and how they need it, you know, and take that to your senior managers and maybe get them involved in that process so that they're hearing from their users that that's the way forward. And if you can get that, you know, that buy-in and them on board, then if you can listen to the rest of the podcast and take the advice on kind of the next steps. But yeah, start with what those people need.
Yeah, and I would say you know, focus on the culture, get that culture going first. And if you have barriers to getting that culture established, look to identify people in your organisation who are really on board with digital and get it, even if they don't use those skill sets themselves. Get them to help you make those arguments and, you know, evidence it with, you know, the user research you've done. And also look to peer pressure, because peer pressure is a wonderful, wonderful thing for changing people's attitudes. So, you know, you might not be able to, you know, change some senior managers' ways of working yourself by talking to them, because they might just, it just might not cut through for them for whatever reason. But if they see other senior managers and other chief execs working in a certain way or understanding it in a different way, that can really, really help to making that sort of first step.
Yeah, I remember one tip that Zoe Amar said in a talk at Charity Comms was one of my favourite tips, was the idea that if you plant seeds but also don't take credit for those seeds.
100%.
Let people just believe that those ideas are theirs.
Yeah.
And you really have to check your own ego on that. Because that's hard for me. And I'm thinking, I want to take credit for that idea, and you can't. And if you don't, it'll happen. It'll be like, I've got the end result. Yeah. You know, like, get over it. Yeah, no, I agree with you.
Yes, yeah. I've had that from getting trying to get senior managers onto social is a real example of that. You suggest it to them and they're like, no, or they go on it and they create a profile and then they never do anything with it. You know, let them come around to the idea. Let them want to do it. As soon as they want to do it, then it flies. Mm. If you're trying to put someone on a platform that they don't want to, of course it's not going to work. Mm. So even though it's a great idea, you have to find ways to let them come to it themselves and think it's good. So it's a different way of introducing things.
Brilliant. I feel like that was really, really coherent, there are first few steps to take through. That's like so applicable across the board. So that's all we've got for you today. So thanks so much for coming in. It's been really, really interesting to hear about how
it works. Thank you. Yeah, thank you for having us.
I hope it continues going so well for you.
Thank you.
It's always so inspiring to hear from small charities who see their size as a superpower, just like CharityComs.
Absolutely, and I think their passion really shone through in everything they were saying, and it really goes through into just how thorough they are about everything. It's completely driven by the fact that they just have a love for what they do and making everything that Bliss puts out the best that it can be, and understanding that digital is a tool to enable you to put out the best you can put out.
Definitely, and the fact that digital is so right for small charities, that was very, very inspiring.
Yeah, absolutely, and they gave so many useful tips as well. I mean, we basically really picked their brains across that whole entire interview, but by the end it was still like, great, here's a load of things we would recommend you do as a small charity if you want to do a complete digital overhaul of your organisation.
Mm-hmm.
And although they obviously had a lot of people who were already on board, so they didn't have to do too much cajoling of their team. They really harnessed that in an impressive way. Well, that's it for this episode. We hope you enjoyed our journey into the small charity world and picked up a few useful tips along the way.
If you're a listener from a small charity, make sure you keep an eye out for when booking opens for the CharityComs annual Small Charities Communications Conference, taking place in July. And as always, if there's anything you'd like to hear more about, or if you've got any questions for us, you can catch us on Twitter. I'm on at @sushi_jugglepa.
And I'm at Robin Lewis. Alternatively, you can reach me at my CharityComs email, which is in the episode description. Make sure you subscribe if you'd like to be notified when we upload. And if you enjoyed the episode, we'd really appreciate a review or rating. We'll see you in the next episode. Bye for now.
Bye.